Well, if you do have a Bible in front of you, I would encourage you to have it open and make yourself able to compare what I say with what the scriptures say. The passage we read in Mark chapter 5 tells us of two of the Lord Jesus' miracles, and I'd like to focus on one in particular, the raising of Jairus' daughter. I'd like to look at it under four headings, and each heading is intended to sum up or refer to in some way one of the people or groups of people that we find in the passage. My first heading is desperate. Desperate, verses 21 to 23. That, of course, is Jairus, who was desperate, living in the middle of personal tragedy. He'd been driven to Jesus by the crisis which must be every parent's nightmare. His little girl's life was ebbing away before his eyes, and he was helpless, could do nothing himself. He loved, surely, to do things for her, but here was the thing she needed most of all, and he couldn't do it. He had no power. We're told in Luke's account that she was his only child. And that surely added the poignancy all its own. Not, of course, that he would have valued her any the less if there'd been others. But to lose an only child, to think that if he lost her, he would never hear a voice saying, "Dad," ever again. Jairus is described here in verse 22 as one of the synagogue rulers. That meant that he was an important and a respected figure in his community. The Jewish synagogue was governed by a body of elders, and Jairus was one of these. He would have been responsible for reading the scriptures on the Sabbath day, probably also for giving a word of explanation. He would have been one of those responsible for reciting the set prayers in front of the congregation. And he also would have been involved in inviting any qualified visitors to read from the scriptures and speak. And of course, this was the whole society was a highly religious society, wasn't it? And that meant that Jairus in that society was a person of some status. People would have recognized him, people would have looked up to him. He was a person of some social standing. And furthermore, men of his type were often to be found in opposition to Jesus. But now, of all times, was not the time to be standing on his dignity. Rank and status, what did they matter now? His house was under the shadow of death. And death has a way of putting things into perspective. Look at him now in verses 22 and 23. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him. All dignity forgotten. He's prostrate on the ground at the feet of Jesus. His clothes are getting into quite a state, but that doesn't matter a bit to him. What does that matter? All that matters is that death has drawn near him and Jesus must come. He forgets his dignity. He comes to Jesus because he was desperate. He had nowhere else to go, as we were thinking a few moments ago in that song. If he'd been sitting on the fence about Jesus, perhaps before now, personal disaster brought him off it. The synagogue where he was an elder, quite possibly, or even likely, was the synagogue at Capernaum. And if it was, that meant that Jairus would have witnessed at least one of Jesus' earlier miracles that's recorded in Mark's Gospel, chapter 1, where Jesus cast a demon out of a person in the synagogue at Capernaum. Jairus quite possibly would have been witness to other miracles too. He also would have been aware, at least to some extent, of Jesus' teaching. We're not told what he thought of that, whether he entirely approved of it. It's quite possible that he didn't. But something made him come to Jesus now, because he knew that with Jesus there was still hope. It was as simple as that. There was still hope for his daughter. Something made him leave his daughter's deathbed. Think of that. He might never see her alive again. He might not even be there for her final moments. But something made him walk or even run down the stairs, out of the door. Something made him run to Jesus. Then of all time. He meets another obstacle. Verse 21 tells us that there was a large crowd gathered around Jesus. Jairus has to make his way through the crowd. How many toes did he tread on accidentally as he did that? How many times did he have to say, "I'm sorry, excuse me, this is urgent"? He's got tunnel vision. He's got to get through that crowd somehow. He's got to get to Jesus. He was desperate. In one sense, it's hardly complimentary to Jesus to say that Jairus was desperate enough to go to him, but nevertheless he came and Jesus accepted him. Some people would say that no hope except Jesus really means no hope. But in Jairus' hour of need, when it really mattered, he knew better. And his crisis brought him, drove him to admit that. Jesus was his only hope, but with Jesus, nevertheless, there was hope, and he knew that. Secondly, unbelieving. Unbelieving. Verses 35 to 37, that's not Jairus I'm referring to, but the messengers who came from his house. We don't know who they were, whether they were friends or members of the wider family, perhaps. But whoever they were, they brought the news that Jairus was dreading to hear. The moment he saw them, his heart must have dropped like a stone. The moment they came in sight, he knew what it was about. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Verse 35. Why bother the teacher anymore? That expression shows that these messengers knew what was going to happen. Or at least they thought so. They'd got it all worked out, so they thought. When Jesus heard that news, only one outcome was possible. Why bother Jesus any further? After all, there was no point now. Not anymore. Jairus, not even Jesus can help you now. Why bother him any further? There may have been some point in going to him while she was still alive, but there's no point now. Why bother him any further? He may be able to do remarkable things, but this thing he cannot do. That's the assumption, isn't it? He may have been able to heal blindness, paralysis. He may have something of a track record in healing various ailments and diseases. He may even be able to cast out the spirits with a word. But this is death, Jairus. This is worse than all of those things. Your daughter is dead. Even Jesus can't help you now. Why bother him anymore? They were so sure. They were so sure that they knew what was going to happen. They were already picturing the scene, probably, in their mind's eyes. As soon as they delivered their message, Jesus would turn to Jairus and he would say, "Jairus, I'm so sorry, it's too late. Nothing I can do for you now. Death is an enemy too strong for me. If only I'd been there sooner, perhaps I shouldn't have stopped so long as I did to talk to that woman. Perhaps if I'd asked her to wait a little longer and hurried to your house. I'm so sorry, Jairus. it's all over. And then Jesus would have turned around and walked away, wouldn't he? Defeated. After all, what else could he do? What else could anyone do in the face of death? They had sympathy, these messengers. They understood that it was better for Jairus to begin to come to terms with what had happened, try to begin to accept it, rather than to cling on to a hope which so obviously was not now going to be fulfilled. They had sympathy, yes, but according to Jesus' words, they had no faith. That was the trouble with them. Jesus did not respond in the way they were expecting. Verse 36, ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." Their assumptions were knocked head over heels by Jesus' response. Don't be afraid, just believe. We have to interpret that in context, of course. Jesus wasn't saying, believe whatever you want to believe and it will all be okay. It's not faith in faith that he was recommending, that he was urging upon Jairus. No, it was faith in Jesus himself. Believe me. Trust me. The verb there, believe, is actually in the present continuous tense. It means go on trusting me, and it implies that Jairus had already begun to trust Jesus. Jairus, you trusted me enough to come to me in your crisis. Don't stop trusting me now. Go on trusting me. I'm still with you. I'm still coming, Jairus. I set out to come and heal your daughter, and I am still coming to heal your daughter. Trust me. Keep trusting me. Not even death changes my plans. Believe me. Those who thought that Jesus was going to have to walk away were not trusting him as much as he wants to be trusted. They thought that he couldn't see the job through. He'd set out for Jairus' house, but he was going to have to bail out. That was their assumption. Death would make him think twice. But it didn't. And notice how Jesus encourages Jairus' faith, not only by his words, but by his actions. Verse 37, he did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John. Up until this point, they'd been walking in the middle of a crowd, hadn't they? And the woman had come up behind him in the crowd. But now Jesus dismisses the crowd. And that meant, of course, that from now on they would make much quicker progress to Jairus' house. Jesus was anxious to remove the distractions, as it were, to Jairus' faith. He wanted Jairus' attention riveted on himself. He wanted to remove the hindrances. And he encouraged, he fueled Jairus' faith, not only by what he said, but by what he did. Unbelieving those messengers were. Thirdly, our third heading is hard, verses 38 to 40. We see some hard people in these verses. We see people turn from wailing to mocking laughter in a matter of seconds. If you look at it, when they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. It's quite a change, isn't it? And it seems very strange to us. It certainly highlights the fact that their grief was not genuine. Part of the explanation is that it was a custom in those days, in that part of the world, to have professional mourners who would swing into action at any funeral. They would set the tone for the occasion. And given that it's also the custom, Jewish custom, to, or at least it was then, in a hot climate, to hold a funeral within 24 hours of the death, well, these professional mourners swung into action very, very quickly. And the scene that greeted Jairus on his return home was very simply a crowd of people preparing his daughter's funeral. Why do I call these people hard? Well, for two reasons. Firstly, and perhaps most obviously, their scornful laughter was grossly insensitive to Jairus and Jairus's wife. Their simulated grief had become so professional, in inverted commas, that it could be switched on or off at a moment's notice. Professionalism had edged out sensitivity to close relatives. But even more importantly than that, these people were hard to the presence of Jesus, and they were hard to the words of Jesus. You notice Jesus' question, verse 39, why? Why all this commotion and wailing? He clearly wanted them to understand this was inappropriate. Why are you doing this? Why are you preparing a funeral? There isn't going to be one. He's actually announcing that, isn't he? But all they could do was laugh. As far as they were concerned, Jesus needed his head examining. And Jesus' words, "The child is not dead but asleep," have sometimes been misunderstood. It has been suggested that all that had really happened was that the girl had fallen into some kind of coma, which the onlookers failed to recognize for what it was. But that isn't the right way to understand Jesus' words here. Luke's gospel tells us very clearly they laughed at him knowing that she was dead. To speak of death as asleep is very common figure of speech. It occurs in a number of different languages, a number of different cultures. Jesus himself used it, actually, on another occasion, speaking of Lazarus, who was most certainly dead. He said, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep." So why did Jesus use that figure of speech on this occasion? Well, it was to show, surely, how short a time death would last in this girl's case. Those who sleep get up in the morning, and death was to be as temporary as that for this young girl. Jesus was revealing to the mourners that this particular death was hardly worthy of the name. It wasn't going to last. "I'm going to end it," he said. "I'm going to get her up." But all they could do was laugh. And yes, that laughter was so insensitive to Jairus and his wife. But it was also very hard towards Jesus. They simply assumed, these people, that Jesus could do nothing. Just like the messengers who'd met Jairus on the way. They simply assumed. Even though Jesus had completely knocked over the expectations of the messengers, he'd kept on his way to Jairus' house. He'd arrived at Jairus' house, still intending to heal his daughter. Nevertheless, these people could only laugh. They didn't even accept the possibility that he might have been able to do something. Well, isn't that understandable? I mean, who could do anything? Isn't it understandable that they wrote Jesus off? I mean, they would have written anybody else off for this purpose, for the purpose of raising someone back to life. And isn't it understandable that they bracketed Jesus along with everybody else? Weren't they right to do that? Well, no. No, they weren't. For one thing, there was the witness of their own scriptures, the Old Testament. Plenty of indications that God is stronger than death, that death would not get its way forever. They knew that death had only come into the world when mankind sinned against God. They knew that almost immediately after that, God had made a great promise to send a rescuer who would put everything right that had just gone wrong. And they knew that as time went on, God had revealed more and more about this person who was to come. There were actual examples in the ministry of Old Testament prophets, Elijah and Elisha, of people being raised to life. There were specific prophecies such as Isaiah's words in chapter 25, verses 7 and 8. On this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. So on the one hand, these mockers had the testimony of their own holy scriptures that God could be expected to do something about death in the end. Then on the other hand, there was what they already knew about Jesus. Jesus had given them plenty of reason to believe that he was no ordinary man. Was this not the man who taught spellbound crowds with a ring of authority which eluded their official teachers? Was this not the man who found no sickness and no disease too hard to heal? Was this not the man who that very day had healed a woman whom no doctor had been able to help? No, the ridicule of these people was actually very shallow. They had the scriptures, they knew lots about Jesus, but they didn't put the two together. Their laughter was cheap and it was rude. But unfortunately, it's not all that unusual, is it? Plenty of people today react to Jesus in exactly that way. Tell them of Jesus' miracles and they can only scoff, or at best shrug their shoulders. Tell them that he himself is coming back one day to judge everyone who's ever lived. Their only answer is ridicule. But ridicule, of course, simply isn't an answer. Because Jesus never broke a promise yet. It's interesting to notice that Jesus' response to these people was very similar to what he'd done to the crowd a little earlier on. Verse 40, he put them all out. Expelled them from the house. They were not to be allowed to threaten Jairus' wavering faith any longer. Again, Jesus is removing obstacles. He's clearing the path. He's focusing Jairus' attention on himself. And that's always a good rule, isn't it? When our faith is wavering, it hardly ever, if ever, helps to focus attention on our faith. We need to focus our attention on the one who's the object of our faith. We need to look again to Jesus himself. We need to do whatever we can to clear away the obstacles, to remove the hindrances and focus our attention on him himself. Isn't that why a quiet time is supposed to be a quiet time? We're supposed to, as far as possible, whenever it is possible, to have a time in each day when we can focus on the word of Christ and on God himself in prayer without distraction. When it's quiet, when there are no hindrances. So that we can hear his voice, the voice of our Saviour in his word, clearly, so that we can focus upon it. Get other things out of the way for a period of time each day. Focus our attention on him. And that's exactly what Jesus was doing here. To support, to strengthen, to fuel, to encourage Jairus' faith. He's removing the obstacles. How tender-hearted he was and is. Well, fourthly, verses 40 to 42, alive is my heading for this, alive. And we're shown here both the power and the tenderness of Jesus. When Jesus commands the impossible, it happens. Where's the use in addressing a corpse? She couldn't hear it. But when Jesus spoke, she could. The command carried the power along with it. If anyone else had given that instruction, it would have remained completely impossible. But when Jesus commanded, it became not only possible, but certain. I think that's why Mark inserts a little phrase in his translation of Jesus' words. Jesus spoke, verse 41, in the Aramaic language, which was the everyday language of many people at that time. And Mark, in translating those words, inserts a phrase. The Aramaic words, talitha kum, literally mean, little girl, get up. But Mark inserts something else. He inserts this little phrase, I say to you. Everyone else could have spoken the same words and nothing would have changed. But I say to you, when Jesus spoke them, the power was present too. There's a great contrast here, isn't there, in this lovely scene with the scene which precedes it in verses 38 and 9. There was no shortage of voices in the house before Jesus arrived. There was a commotion, Mark describes it, verse 38, a commotion with people crying and wailing. The house was noisy. Matthew's Gospel tells us that there were people playing flutes. It was all part of the package at a funeral. But all that noise, all those voices had done no good. Not one had penetrated the ears of the dead girl. But Jesus, verse 40, put them all out. Enough of all those voices. And suddenly the house is quiet. Too quiet, really. There should have been a 12-year-old girl running around or bustling around or whatever 12-year-old girls do. But it's completely still. And so is she. And Jesus, together with the girl's parents and three of his own disciples, approaches that horribly still body. And Jesus speaks two quiet words. That's all it takes. That's all. Easy to see whose voice is worth listening to. And Jesus, as well as speaking with power, also speaks with great tenderness, great compassion. Why does Mark record his words in the original Aramaic language here? Well, surely to draw attention to the fact that he was using an everyday expression. Jesus was speaking in the very words of daily life. This was the expression people would have used to get their children out of bed in the morning. Time to get up. Up you get. Come on. He spoke to her as if she was his own daughter. And he was waking her up in the morning. To raise someone from death itself is no harder than that for him. Well, of course, this girl would get older, she would grow up, and one day she would die again. I like to think that in her better moments, at least, she wasn't afraid to die anymore. She'd already done it. Why should she be afraid? She knew what would happen. And she could think to herself, when I lie down to die, it'll just be asleep. He'll get me up in the morning. It'll be the same voice, won't it? the tenderest voice I ever heard. The voice so tender, even the dead can't refuse it. And what about Jairus himself? In later years, as he got old and as he approached his own death, did he hear to himself an echo in his memory? Did he hear again those words of blessed reassurance, those words of heavenly pity? Don't be afraid. Just believe. Yes, we thank you for your sweet compassion to the needy. And we, Lord, are needy. You know our faith is weak and often wavering. Be pleased to strengthen it, just as you did with Jairus all those years ago. Be pleased to walk with us and enable us when we face trials, when we come to face our last enemy. Be pleased to reassure our hearts. Be pleased to make yourself real and full of tender compassion to our minds and hearts. Amen.